Absolutely riveting information from Bob Cohen and Eric Nadler. We're going to take phone calls next hour with both of them, but when I come back, more to talk about on Coast to Coast AM. Bob, let's pick up this story about these germs being stored somewhere in South Africa.
Well, just as I was saying, what emerged after the anthrax attacks was that South Africa never actually destroyed its germ warfare stocks. It was still a stockpile out there, and it was in control of people who were supposedly affiliated with a right-wing international network. Some have called this the Order of the Rose. We also do know for a fact that the South African regime had close ties with groups in the United States, in particular this one very strange, another dead scientist, a fellow by the name of Larry Ford, who was a California gynecologist. He actually had clients. Some of these clients are pretty famous, Bianca Jagger, Margot Hemingway. But Larry Ford was an eccentric Mormon doctor. But he had a dark side. He was moonlighting for the South African program, bringing over all kinds of germs. A lot of people have claimed that Larry Ford had CIA connections. And basically, Larry Ford in 2000 blew his brains out.
Another one.
Yeah, with a shotgun. And basically, the cops were responding to this, and he lived in Irvine, a very nice neighborhood in Irvine, California there. And the police were responding to this suicide, and they got a call for an FBI informant who features in the film. And they were warned, don't go in there. There's a bio-war germ stash hidden away and weapons thing. Just be very careful. So the FBI and the feds and the local police evacuate the whole neighborhood and go in there with hazmat teams, and they discovered hundreds of canisters of germs that they pulled away, and then they dug up the backyard, and there was a whole explosive and weapons cache as well. Now, some people have started to look into who was Larry Ford. The local detective in Irvine, California, started digging around before the FBI came in and said, we're taking over, and basically have sealed pretty much everything. We don't know what was taken away. Who Larry Ford was working for, but what has emerged, and some journalists, including ourselves, have looked into this. Well, he was connected with a right-wing supremacist, white supremacist group. He had dealings with groups in Nevada. There was talk about a anthrax in a gold mine outside of Henderson, Nevada, and links to these shadowy right-wing groups. So a lot of stories out there, very little sort of hard evidence. We tried digging around a lot. We did manage to get hold of Larry Ford's FBI file, which was pretty much 90% redacted on the national security grounds. So that tells you something.
Have you heard about the story also of a James Patrick Riley from BioPhem Pharmaceuticals? And apparently he was shot.
Well, that was Larry Ford's partner. So, Ford and Riley were partners, and they had this little biotech firm that was involved in developing a drug that had something to do with HIV that could help prevent supposedly HIV in women. And they're doing all their research where, of all places, South Africa. And one of the strange things that Larry Ford was up to, he was shipping bottles and bottles of amniotic fluid taken from pregnant black women in South Africa, and shipping it back to the United States disguised as wine. Now, what was that all?
Why?
Well, we don't know. There's a lot of unanswered questions about what Larry Ford was up to. But, we did talk to Dr. Death, and we asked him, well, did you know Larry? And he said, yeah, Larry's a wonderful good fellow. He used to come over here, jump on an airplane, and show up with vials of all kinds of wonderful germs that he said could do all kinds of things.
Wonderful germs. And they're in a different world, those people, aren't they?
Absolutely. And the FBI informant basically says that, he was around. Ford when he was boasting that he developed an ethnic weapon. So many unanswered questions about all this, but basically it comes down to this world of germ warfare, which is just so full of secrets and a lot of stuff that people don't want to come out. Because at the end of the day, George, this is the subversion of the life sciences. This, the sciences are supposed to do good, find cures, help humanity. And actually what they're doing with germ warfare, they're turning the life sciences into the death sciences.
And I have to assume that they have things that would defy our imagination.
Well, technological advances in biomedical research have been breathtaking, and the germ warriors have taken full advantage of all the new techniques from genetic engineering to nanotechnology. One of the more interesting recent news events your audience will be interested in is in California. A local group finally got an answer to their FOIA request that they had filed to find out what was going on at Lawrence Livermore Laboratories, a government contractor, national security facility there. And they actually got information that they were using recombinant DNA techniques on select agents. That's everything from anthrax to Ebola to all kinds of bad germs. We're not sure what they are, but the term select agents means it's dangerous stuff. And the CDC found out about this and ordered them to stop those experiments, which were illegal. It is illegal to do recombinant DNA research. And the fact that this has come out, they put out a press release, this little group in California, and it got absolutely no play. Like, this is one of those stories that is across the line that the mainstream media absolutely refuses to deal with. Absolute government confirmation that a government laboratory was doing illegal work with select agents. That's dynamite stuff. It's front page material. It doesn't exist in our media.
Let's talk about these microbiologists now who have been dying on this planet for a number of years. How did you two start putting the puzzle together?
Well, there are internet lists that go up to 40 names. You just type in dead microbiologists and you'll see all the names. And it seemed to us an interesting exercise to, you know, separate the wheat from the chaff. Who were major players? Who had suspicious deaths? Was there anything to this? I mean, this phenomenon was such that the New York Times magazine did an article on it and said these deaths, though unusually high, some people said as much as 40, 50 since the 2001 attacks, the Times said it was within the realm of a statistical probability. So that was their answer to it. But we looked at a couple of leading cases. Ivins was the latest, maybe the greatest. David Kelly was certainly a nice piece of business. I forget if we covered this, but the basic thing in the Kelly case is he is said to have slit his wrists and taken an overdose of pills. And the forensic details are such that experts have written to British newspapers, respected surgeons, vascular surgeons, say the artery he's supposed to have cut would not have caused that bleeding. We interviewed people who said the body of Kelly was moved between the time they discovered it. Jeez. We spoke to the people who discovered the body, and they talked about the discrepancies in the official police report. And the more telling than anything was the police admission to a member of parliament that there were no fingerprints on the knife that Kelly allegedly used.
After he died, he just dusted them off, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. You know, he just dusted them off. So basically, Kelly was a great dead scientist. And another one that made the book and the film is Vladimir Pasechnik, who was the leading Soviet defector who came to England, defected in Paris, and Kelly went over there and they got him back to England, and Kelly did the whole debriefing. And Pasechnik revealed that the Soviets had an unbelievably dangerous, illegal germ warfare program for decades that was hidden within a vast network of front medical operations. They had done horrible things with anthrax, state-of-the-art genetic manipulation, and perhaps most alarming is Pasechnik said they had the ability to put bubonic plague on an onto an ICBM, and this was disturbing news. And Pasechnik dies while the anthrax attacks are happening, the result of a stroke. He was another man who knew perhaps too much, because he knew the Soviet secrets. And then when he came to the West, he was set up in a private firm by Kelly in the privatized biodefense sector, continuing his research under the guise of defense. And he also had contracts with the United States Navy. So Pasechnik knew top secret stuff for the U.S., the U.K., and the Soviets. And, it's just a dangerous business. You either kill yourself, you're murdered, or you have a stroke, all with quote marks around them. So,
interesting profession for college kids, huh?
Hey, it's tough to get a job these days. Who knows?
So what are the theories here, the speculative theories, of course, on why they're dying? I would think murder. I think both of you would think of murder in most cases as well. Why? Why eliminate them?
Well, I think, George, an interesting case is one more scientist that we looked at was Frank Olson, and perhaps he was the first, 1953. This was a U.S. Army scientist working at the same place where Bruce Ivins was working, working with anthrax, funnily enough. But he was working with a secret division at Fort Detrick called Special Operations. It was actually affiliated with the CIA and headed by a guy by the name of Sidney Gottlieb, who was the mastermind of the MK Ultra program. Anyway, Frank Olson, it turns out, was sent around the world and to monitor certain experiments that were going on with some of our U.S. partners. And he was at Portendown, funnily enough, at the time of these human experiments. And Frank Olson returned from his European trip in 1953, where he'd visited Portendown. He'd visited a place in Germany where he witnessed human experiments, and came back and told his family, you know, he was really depressed and said, you know, I've really made a bad mistake here. I want to get out of this. And Frank Olson basically tendered his resignation, said, I'm getting out. And the folks he worked with down at Fort Detrick in Special Operations said, Frank Olson, you know, you're just a little depressed. Let's go to New York. We've got a good doctor for you to see.
Yeah.
And basically, Frank Olson came down to New York City and was in a hotel in 50 on by Penn Station. And at 2 a.m., fell 13 floors to his death. Hotel window. His family was told it was an accident, something happened, never fully explained. But his son, by the name of Eric Olson, who was only 9 years old at the time, basically never bought the cover story. Many years later, the government said they slipped him LSD in this experiment.
He was the one. Okay.
That's the guy with the LSD. And they gave the family some money. This was President Ford in 1976 and apologized for this thing, but the son believed that even that was a cover story, that there was more to it.
There might have been, yeah.
And so what he did was that he exhumed his father's body in 1994, and he got the top forensic pathologist in the country to examine it, and he found evidence that that Frank Olson had actually been hit in the head and murdered before being thrown out the window.
Unbelievable.
Now, it comes back to your question, George, why? Now, Eric Olson, we interview him for the book and the film, and he's got a really good point. When you've got guys who are involved in this most secret of secret stuff, this most diplomatically explosive stuff, and they come to a point and they say, we want out. We shouldn't be doing this thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I've crossed the line. What do you do with these guys?
Yeah. First of all, you're afraid they're going to rat on you, right?
Well, that's it, right? You can't put them on trial. You can't send them to Siberia, right? Where, you know, we can't do that in this country, but what do you do? And that's a really, interesting question. And certainly if we look at the case of David Kelly, one of the things we do know was that he was thinking about writing a book. And it approached publishers and writers, and we talked to a few of those folks. We also know that a few years before his death, he converted to the Baha'i faith, which is a religion that sort of, it's a world culture religion. It embraces all religions, all peoples. Its basic tenet is world peace and understanding among human beings. And David Kelly converted to the Baha'i faith. And by the way, Baha'is are not allowed to commit suicide. And apparently he got into this Baha'i stuff. And perhaps David Kelly was a man who had a change of heart, you know, who said, you know, this is not good.
Maybe it was the change of heart that got him killed.
We don't know. And we certainly know that he was privy to all the secrets. He knew everything about this dirty germ war world. And perhaps these guys like Frank Olson sign up believing they're doing the right thing, that they're on the good side. It's maybe once they get into it a little deeply that they realize that, well, you know, then, you know, maybe we shouldn't be doing this.
Well, what's amazing, Bob and Eric, is that it's almost as if these people can get away with murder. They probably figure it doesn't matter. Nobody's going to say anything. Nobody's going to do anything. You know, it may end up in a book, but it won't be with my name. So what? And they go off and they kill these people. And they're gone. I have long suspected that these people also were working on a project that is so big, in tandem, perhaps with each other. There might be a link. Have you been able to find a link between these dead microbiologists where they all come to one point?
On the internet, one reads many things and one tries to, as I say, separate the wheat from the chaff. And we came across a very interesting article by a great British investigative writer named Gordon Thomas. He's just published a big book on British intelligence that's a big bestseller. In Britain, we were just over there, and it's in all the bookshop windows. Gordon is in our film. We interviewed him for the book. He wrote an article that was published in a British paper, which indicated that a couple of these guys were working on a project that involved DNA level understanding and basically work that might have involved phages. Phages are a very interesting piece of business. Pisechnik was a phage expert. Phage is a way to fight infections. We use antibiotics in the West, and the phage industry was destroyed by the antibiotic industry. But in the former Soviet Union, Soviet scientists kept the phage operation alive, and after the fall of the Soviet Union, these guys began opening themselves to the West. Phage therapy is what Pisechnik had a contract with the U.S. Navy for. And some of these people, they say, are working on that. In other words, anthrax antidotes that were big-ticket items.
Interesting. And I wonder if they're setting us up for something even bigger. What do you think?
It's quite possible. I mean, even a sober observer looks at what's happening with alarm. The key thing that we've learned is that there is no difference between biodefense and biooffense. Biooffense is outlawed by international treaty, which the U.S. and the Soviet Union has signed. But biodefense is allowable. But essentially, the R&D that you need for this is interchangeable. One of the things, let me give you an example.
All right, let's take that example, Bob and Eric, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And next hour, of course, we'll take phone calls. With our special guest, Bob Cohen, Eric Nadler, their work, Dead Silence. Next hour, we'll take phone calls. We'll continue with the story when we come back. Okay, Bob and Eric, let's pick up the story again where we were as we were talking about these microbiologists who seem to have been murdered or they die under very mysterious circumstances all around this planet. Go ahead, Bob.
Eric, I just want to finish that thing on what they're doing in the labs these days is in order to make vaccines and biodefense work, which is allowed, they are absolutely mixing in new concoctions of germs. The thinking goes like this. They actually do sit around and say, what if the terrorists mixed anthrax with Ebola and then genetically manipulated it? And they have to think, okay, how do we countermeasure that? So in the labs, they're actually creating these terrible things to see how to defend against it. And it's just increasing. There's 15,000 people who have security clearances now to work with these select agents. There are 200 laboratories across the United States, including in large population centers. There's all kinds of security problems and the lack of oversight enforcement. The NIH is doing a terrible job in watching what's happening in these labs, that they do it safely. So basically, germ war is coming to a neighborhood near you, but it's not the terrorists who are bringing it. It's the bioterror military industrial complex.
Our own people.
Yeah.
You know what amazes me, too, when this swine flu story broke several months ago, and I've always been saying there's not going to be a pandemic, yet the World Health Organization is now calling it a pandemic, even though there's only been 29,000 cases worldwide. We get the more than that for just the normal flu. Yeah, there was a scientist who came out and said this was made in a laboratory, and they hushed that up. Do you remember that?
Certainly we've heard that claim, George, that swine flu and all sorts of things are being brought to life in the labs. And it is remarkable that we're talking to you, the day after that they declared swine flu a pandemic around the globe.
Yeah.
This is the first time this has happened in 40 years.
I mean, I'm saying to myself, what do they know that we don't? I mean, it's almost as if they understand that maybe it was made, they've released it, and it will be a problem.
Well, some observers, Georgia, look in this as a way of basically prepping the public, getting them ready.
For something.
For something. It's being hyped by the media for sure. I mean, like you said, we get more than 10,000 people a year who die of an ordinary flu. And so what have we got here now, 1,200 cases?
29,000 cases worldwide. We have 36,000 people who die from these 29,000 people. Only a handful have died.
Exactly. So in some ways, they're getting ready, putting plans afoot, contingency plans for how do we deal with a pandemic. But, another interesting thing, George, that you probably, I don't know, might be aware of, and I'm sure a lot of the audience have no idea, was that last October, the Department of Health and Human Services declared a 7-year national anthrax emergency. Did you know that
Now
we're living in an official government-declared anthrax emergency?
What's the emergency?
Well, that's the old thing. What is the emergency? Why was that declared? Well, what it does is we know now already the anthrax vaccine is mandatory for all U.S. troops deployed overseas into theaters of war like Afghanistan and Iraq. It's been mandatory since the 90s, and a lot of soldiers have refused that shot.
And I think that's gotten some of them sick, too.
Exactly. So now, with this new law, they can begin giving the anthrax shot and make two first responders, civilian first responders, police, firemen, ambulance guys, emergency responders. Their plans afoot to get this to the postal workers next, and already plans, if need be, to inoculate the general population and build up the stockpiles. So this is all going on as we speak.
And quarantine those that don't take the vaccine.
Certainly. I mean, this is all part of a contingency plan of how we deal with these pandemics. And the CDC has got plans right now for certain airports to be quarantine sites in pandemics, to divert flights if they have to. That was just reported yesterday. So certainly it does look like there are plans afoot, preparations for large-scale pandemics. And some might say, well, maybe it's germ war. Maybe germ war is coming. They're getting ready for it. In
good
some
point.
Ways.
So, good point. That old movie, What's It All About, Elfie? What is it all about? I mean, and that is a very good point. Maybe germ warfare is coming, and either they know it's coming because they've heard things, or maybe we're going to initiate it. I don't know which.
And also, it's the business of getting ready for war, bio war and germ war, is huge. People are making a lot of money on all this, and it's become the bioterror military-industrial complex.
So, is it safer, in their minds, these sick people who are doing this, to release these biologicals as opposed to a nuclear bomb?
I don't think they think it's a good thing at all. Some of them don't even think about it. I mean, the scientific community, the scientists are focused on the technical problems and the university grants and tenure and consulting contracts and, a nice car. Basically, I don't think a lot of people are thinking about the bigger questions. They just go where the money's going. On the top level, what are these policy makers thinking? I don't know. I think it's madness, and I think we're heading towards a catastrophe.
And then I think, George, one of the big things in all this is always there's got to be a justification, the fear factor. And for a long time, it was the Soviets, the communists, were the big threat. They were going to, the bad guys of the germs. Now it's the unnamed terrorists who are out there who are going to do us harm. So, the fear factor plays into it. The media does, and the movies too. All these thrillers that we've seen, biological thrillers, in some way, prepare the public for this, and is always the fear is used as a justification for this. So one of the things that is important for us is that we don't necessarily we should all be concerned about this, but at the same time we should also empower ourselves, educate ourselves. See, what can we do to stop this? How can we get involved? How can we call for more oversight, for more regulations, for our politicians to tackle this issue, for our media to take this issue seriously, and find out what is going on in our communities in these labs?
I think so, too. Of the two major labs you've talked about, the Fort Detrick one, here in Porton Down in the United Kingdom, which one is the bigger of the two? Is it Detrick?
Yeah, I think the U.S. Takes the lead in certain programs ahead of the British. But the U.S. has a network, and Detrick works closely with the Dugway Proving Grounds and Edgewood Arsenal, also pieces of the germ warfare complex. Dugway, out in the vast deserts of Utah, is where they test chemical and biological agents, ostensibly for detection systems. But they're also testing it on the battlefield. Basically, the military does exercises there in the desert that is suited to a bio-weapons, bio-war scenario. And, they're noticing this in Moscow and Tehran and China. And they're wondering, my God, what are these guys doing? What's going on? And Putin, in his last speech as, I believe, prime minister or president, I get mixed up which one he was and is now, in his last speech to the Russian...
Now he's the prime minister.
Okay, so his last speech as president, his speech to the Russian Supreme Council, he said that the West is making... dangerous advances in nanotechnology, information technology, and bio defense technology. And he says, we notice this and we will not be left behind. So basically, it looks like we might be in the midst of a germ war arms race. And that's why it's very important to get a political movement going. We had a screening on Capitol Hill last week, which was well attended, and we also had in attendance Representative Rush Holt and Representative Gerald Nadler, who are the co-sponsors of a bill to call for a national commission to study the FBI's handling of the anthrax case. I think it's a very important bill, which give Congress subpoena power. We might be getting to the bottom of this. It's a question whether the Democratic leadership will push for it. It doesn't seem to be high on the agenda. But if enough citizens contact their congressman and put pressure on, maybe we can actually even get a hearing or something done there. So that's the political action we're talking about.
Does the Carlyle Corporation, the Carlyle Group, does that name pop up at all in any of your work and research?
Yeah, the Carlyle Group always pops up, you know, because they've got the highest levels political connections worldwide. Everybody from, you know, former President Bush 1, to former British Prime Minister John Major, that kind of thing. And so they're very they're wired into the highest levels of corporate government and intelligence circles. They're powerful. Their tentacles are said to be everywhere. But pinning these guys down in a lot of cases is difficult.
It's a private company, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
They own more than 600 corporate and real estate groups. That's pretty big.
Wow. That is big, and that translates into political influence. So Carlyle Group, while not the subject of our investigation, I think is worthy of continued surveillance.
Absolutely. And again, you know, the money trail, you follow the money. In this particular case, we talk about the $57 billion. Does it get bigger? How much more money's involved?
Well, we don't really know, George. But certainly, if we're talking that it's $57 million in the U.S., $57 billion in the U.S. government contract alone, there's a lot of money out there, and this is global. This is happening all over the world. It's being privatized. These vaccines are big business for these corporations, the research, all this. But, and again, this is part of the problem. It's so much of this is shrouded in secrecy. We don't know what's going on in these labs. We don't know a lot about you know, the black budgets, for instance. So we need more transparency. We need to for people also to educate themselves and also try to find out what's going on in their communities, in these labs, in university labs, because, you know, there could be a university right near you that's conducting research, classified research on anthrax, that could pose a threat to your communities. Because one of the things about this, George, is that, you know, unlike nuclear weapons, and you know, we interviewed a great expert on this, Professor Jonathan King from MIT, and he made this really good point. He said even an oil spill will degrade over time. Even nuclear leak and nuclear radiation actually will, you know, over many decades will dissipate. But germs, once they're out there, they reproduce.
Yes.
You can't pull them back.
They run rampant all over the place.
And there have been leaks. There have been escapes of these agents. I mean, we traveled to Russia to a place used to be called Sverdlovsk, on the edge of Siberia. It was one of the centers of the secret Soviet program, and they had a secret military lab there where they were weaponizing anthrax, and had a big operation there. And one night the night shift came in, they forgot to change a filter, and a little bit of anthrax, some people say it was just 1 gram, floated up out into the vents and went across the sleeping city, and they had this huge outbreak of anthrax, and over 60 people, at least 66 people died.
Jeez.
And we went there and we found some of the victims, spoke to them, and the Soviet authorities covered it up for years. Basically said that happened, it was bad meat. But that could happen anywhere. That could happen here in the United States, an accident, a crazy scientist, or, you know, even darker scenarios. Well, maybe we've got to test this stuff, and the government tests it itself on its unsuspecting public.
How do people die with anthrax?
Basically, what happens is the anthrax is naturally occurring. It occurs in Africa and Asia. Here in the United States, it lives in the soil.
It's a spore, isn't it?
It's a spore, exactly. It's a bacteria, and it mostly infects hooved animals, cattle,
horses.
Goats, exactly, horses, and usually humans can contract anthrax either in two ways, actually eating contaminated meat or coming into contact with hide meat, and you've got a cut and it gets into your bloodstream. That's called cutaneous anthrax. But the anthrax that is used in BioWar is a very different kind of anthrax. It's inhalational anthrax. And what they do is they take these spores, they have to refine them, they have to mill them, and make them small enough that they can actually breathe into your lungs and get past all your membranes and everything into the deepest recesses of the lungs, and it gets into your bloodstream, and then the bacteria attacks the body, and it's a very painful death, and you get ulcers and swelling and internal bleeding and all sorts of horrible things, and very painful, horrible death in a few days.
In your opinion, both of you, what do you believe is the big picture here?
Well, the big picture is that I think we're in a dangerous situation where there appears to be a germs war arms race underway globally that the corporate sector is profiting from and the general populace knows nothing about, and for which there is no political will to even look at this by the media and then to organize around it. People don't even know about this. We interviewed for our book a wonderful fellow named Ed Hammond. He ran an organization called the Sunshine Project, which was the only project. And I say everyone go to their website because they have the best data on everything germ war related. Ed was a crazy man. He filed 31,000 Freedom of Information Act requests. And so what he was able to get from the government is pretty great, but he basically was a one-man band, and he couldn't raise money even from, you know, reputable foundations or peace foundations. They said, yeah, with nuclear stuff, we can rally and get deterrence and maybe a lessening of arsenals, but this bio stuff, the interests are too big. So Ed Hammond had to close up the only NGO looking at germ war, and his wife is Colombian, and he lives in Bogota now, and I think he's teaching English as a second language.
Jeez, just an amazing story. How long did it take you two to put this together?
Well, we've been, Bob started looking and thinking about this years ago. And so it took years. But once we got together and got the funding to actually run around the world to do the research from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and French and German television interests, it took us about 5 years.
That's a long time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Tell me about it.
Like Woodward and Bernstein, I don't think they were too concerned about their own safety. What about you two?
Oh, there are hairy times. I mean, the hairiest time was, we went to the Soviet Union. We went to the place where the anthrax supposedly leaked from, which is something called Compound 19. And Compound 19 was admitted as the source of the leak of anthrax by Boris Yeltsin during a brief moment of perestroika. The new Putin regime came in and said, no military activity there, no leak, terrorists did it. Okay, that's the official line. Well, so we went to film the perimeter of Compound 19 for our film. We had to get the shot. And that was kind of a nerve-wracking moment because there we were on tourist visas, filming perhaps a secret germ war labs, and that was a nervous moment. There's a great scene in the book. I won't give it away. You got to go buy the book.
Yeah, you guys got to be careful. Up next, phone calls with our two guests on Coast to Coast AM.